Welcome to the Jonah Carey Podcast, friends. Thank you so much for tuning in to the show. Today's guest is a fantastic one. It is Daniel Negreanu. Daniel Negreanu, one of the best poker players in the world, and so much fun to chat with him. As I mentioned on the podcast while talking to him, which I guess is a nerdy and ridiculous thing to do, but I have a home game every Monday, and friends were over, and we started talking, and they said, oh, what's up with you? What's up with you? I said, I got Daniel Negreanu on the podcast. They said, well, you have to ask him about tells and ask him about this and this and this, and it's fun because it's, you know, if you play pickup basketball and are lousy at it, and then you could talk to Michael Jordan or LeBron or Steph Curry, that's pretty great. And Negreanu has that kind of status in the poker world, one of the greatest players in the world, has been for quite a long time, and a good Canadian boy, worked his way up. It's a great story, and he was engaging and fun, and we had a really good chat, and I think you'll dig this a lot. And even if you don't play poker, just somebody who kind of made it in this way and really bootstrapped himself, so to speak, is pretty cool. He just kept playing and playing and playing and playing and was really disciplined about it and got a lot better. And lo and behold, you can sit at the top of the mountain. So pretty neat. And I appreciate Mr. Negreanu coming on the podcast. Hey, some programming notes. So CBS Sports is where you will find lots and lots of writing. I've got pieces on all manner of stuff. I think by the time you get this podcast or soon after, I'll have a neat piece up about the Cincinnati Reds, actually. I'm pretty excited about this one. Got to talk to their new manager, David Bell, and their new pitching coach, Derek Johnson, about their pitching philosophy. And they totally remade their pitching staff this year. And I am bullish on the Reds. Let's just say that if I were writing an over-under column this year, which I will be, of course, and the number is about 76 this year, I'd go over. I think they're going to be pretty interesting and could be a sleeper team. I know a lot of the deals that they made are one-year contracts, you know, picking up guys like Puig and Kemp and other walkier sort of guys, but they actually have the makings of a little something here. So, you know, is that going to mean a playoff run? I don't know, but I appreciated Bell and Johnson taking the time to chat, and I got some real perspective on this club. It's always cool when you can get the doors opened a little bit, and just based on the conversations, and granted they're just conversations, but two smart gentlemen. I feel like if you're a Reds fan, you might be in good hands for the next little while with Bell and Johnson running the show. So enjoy that and some other stuff that I've got going on at CBS Sports as well. And that's about it. Hope everything is going great for all of you, wherever you are in this corner of the universe. And please enjoy this edition of the Jonah Carey Podcast. It is with Daniel Negreanu. So I need to start with an anecdote, a story, if you will, Mr. Negreanu. So we have a home game every Monday night, and a buddy of mine was in Vegas for Super Bowl, went to watch the game, and he flew straight from Vegas pretty much to the home game, which we've had for a little while now, and it was a lot of fun. And everybody exchanged pleasantries. How you doing? How you doing? Good, everybody says. What are you up to, John? And I'm like, oh, well, I'm going to have Daniel Negreanu on the podcast. So madness ensues. What? Unbelievable. Wow, crazy. Can't believe. Amazing. You need to invite him to your home game. Your buddy just came from Vegas to the home game, so you have to do it too. So we're going to start with this. How many times a week does somebody say, oh, bro, we got this great home game. You should totally come play?
About 31 times a week.
That's what I figured. Well, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So let's start here. I like to do personal journey stuff. I've got a whole bunch of kind of craft questions that I want to ask you, and we'll get a chance to promote your masterclass, which looks really, really cool and exciting. So we could talk about that as we go along. But I want to start with how you got into it in the first place, because, you know, I think that if you have a decent brain on you and you're into numbers and you're into socialization, whatever, you've probably played at some point. But to go from that to getting good, and then to go from getting good to getting really good, and then to go from getting really good to putting skin in the game, and then to go from putting skin in the game to seeking a game anywhere you can, going anywhere you can to possibly get one, what is in the blood that drives you
to just be determined to play poker as much as humanly possible and get to be, you know, one of the greatest players in the world.
Yeah, well, one thing that I would say is that, you know, there's going to be from this point. You know, I didn't play poker even as a teen for nothing, you know.
Yeah.
I had only been $1 to $5 games, but we're always playing for something. And it started out just as a competitive pursuit. I loved to compete. I wasn't ever going to be an NHL player or an NBA player. But luckily for me, you know, with poker, there's no sort of barrier for entry in terms of physical stature. And I've always been extremely competitive. And early on, just playing with players that were all better than me, was kind of like a really challenging. It was just a very motivating way to approach playing because I just wanted to be better than them.
Yep.
And then I moved on to bigger and better things, and I wanted to be better than them. And that continued all the way through, you know, coming to Las Vegas and playing against the big boys, getting my butt kicked several times. And then ultimately, you know, being able to beat them as well.
What were some of the mistakes that you made early on? Yeah, we could define early on however you want. We could define it as life in North York. We could define it as the first time you went to Vegas. Anywhere you want to go. But what were the things that you were not doing as well as you needed to? Was it just a matter of tactics, like you were playing position wrong? Was it a matter of reading people incorrectly? Was it a matter of reading yourself incorrectly? What were your Achilles heels as you were coming up?
So honestly, in Toronto, I had things pretty nailed down.
Okay.
I was, you know, a big fish in a small pond.
Yep.
And then going to Las Vegas, some of the things I did was basically, you know, abandon some of the routine that I created as a teenager. When I was in Toronto, I was playing noon to 8, Monday to Friday, every week, and I would quit at 8 p.m., played 8-hour sessions without fail. So it was very structured.
Yep.
Lifestyle. It was very stable. When I found myself in Las Vegas, I found myself playing a lot of 20, 30, 40-hour sessions when I was behind.
Oh.
You know, playing all through Saturday night, playing all through the day, maybe playing for 2 days straight, just chasing, if you will. And that's really a big leap for a lot of poker players in that they play longer sessions when they're losing, and then when they're winning, you know, they get up and go.
Hmm. Well, and that's an interesting one. By the way, chasing is such a good way to play it, of course, because that can be a problem tactically and it becomes a problem lifestyle-wise. But I'm wondering about stamina. You know, if you – 8 is makes sense. 40 is too much. But even playing 8 or even playing 9 or 10 but playing it against world-class competition and you cannot make an error. I mean, you need to understand what that seemingly innocuous 3 of club means on the turn every single time. How does one develop the mental stamina? The physical stamina, sure, but the mental stamina to sit there and be locked for that long a period of time, because that is not what any of our jobs require unless, I don't know, you're running very heavy machinery or a spaceship or whatever. Most of us can tune out over the course of a day. You don't have that luxury.
Yeah, well, so it's kind of a fallacy to think that, you know, poker players, you know, are not going to make an error, much like golf. You know, like every time a golfer hits a 100-yard shot,
yeah,
like they're trying to make the shot. Obviously, they don't. So the goal is, as a professional, is to have your misses be smaller.
Hmm.
So your mistakes are smaller. They're less significant. You're not making whopping big blunders, but you're always going to make, you know, a call in the river where the guy has, where you maybe, you know, could have possibly folded or things like that. That's just part of it. As far as, like, you know, the endurance and stuff like that, that's something that comes with practice, to say, you know, to some degree. But also, typically, when you're playing for 8 hours, you're usually playing with the same other people who are playing for 8 hours.
It's true.
It becomes problematic if, let's say, for example, you've been playing with five guys who have been playing for 48 hours straight, and some guy wakes up at 9 a.m., has coffee, orders his breakfast, and comes in fresh. It's kind of like, dude, you know what? You don't need to. It's not quite fair for you to be in this game right now. But you find with time that, you know, the stamina develops, the mental stamina, and some people excel at it, and other people really crumble after, you know, 10 to 12 hours of play.
No question. And it's interesting you cited other sports too, and you know, growing up a Canadian, obviously the appeal to want to play in the NHL, so forth. In those sports, we know what the training methods are. You know, if you want to be an ace left winger and maybe go play for the Edmonton Oilers one day, okay, you work on your lower body, you get in the weight room, you practice skating drills, you go at 4 a.m., mom and dad takes you, you go up, you play A, junior, you move up. All these things happen. With poker, these rituals exist. It's not that they don't, but they don't get talked about as much, I feel like. In other words, we can watch, you know, the World Series on TV, we can have analysis, but there's a certain lore that's attached with, you know, the baseball player who goes in the offseason and gains 15 pounds of muscle, the basketball player who's a, you know, doesn't have a great jumper and he shows up after summer and all of a sudden he's draining threes. What is it for you that you can do and have done, aside from just the hours at the table, which is going to be the most important thing, how does one train to be a really good poker player when you're not playing poker?
Well, that's a very, very important question to bring up, and there are three specific areas to train. One is learning the fundamentals. That's practice. That's studying hands. That's breaking down the mathematics, using what's known as like different computer software to really learn how to play the actual game better.
Yep.
The second is your mental stamina, your mental health, which is, you know, some meditation, you know, personal care. Third, and this, as you, you know, you pointed on, in terms of stamina, when you're physically fit and we're, you know, taking care of your body, you will be able to stay longer hours, more so than somebody who's out of shape but doesn't have that sort of stamina. So physical fitness, mental fitness, and then also spending a good amount of time studying and analyzing your game and the leaks and flaws and how to improve upon those.
So were you cheeseburgers and milkshakes and now you're quinoa and kale?
Well, I'm a vegan and I have been for
that'll do it.
Almost 20 years yeah. now. But yeah, I mean, you know, in the teen years, I did a lot of stupid things like eat dead cows and stuff like that. I don't do that anymore. But I did a lot of that in my teen years.
Yep.
It was funny. Then I realized, like, you know, through research stuff, I was much healthier once I made the switch, felt more energetic. Like, turning vegan was probably one of the more important parts of my poker career because it increased my stamina, my energy levels, lethargicness. I didn't get sick. It was probably, for my poker game, one of the more significantly positive decisions I ever made.
I also wonder, and I've interviewed various athletes or Justin Trudeau, high-achieving people, and I always wonder when you achieve a high level and then you take it off the court or you take it out of the forum and you are interacting with your partner, especially your partner. It can be your friends too, but especially your partner. You are this singularly driven person, extremely talented, extremely hardworking, and so damn focused in the zone all the time. When you step away at the proverbial 8:01 p.m., are you a normal person? Or, and I'm not trying to be facetious or flip or whatever, I mean it honestly, or are you just really intense and it takes a partner or a group of friends to really understand, you know what, that's how Daniel rolls, he's just like that.
You know, most poker players are pretty much like intense when they play. I don't think I'm one of those people. Pretty casual and jovial, and I joke around, and it's kind of like, you know, extroverted at the poker table. And then in my regular life, I'm like, people are really surprised to hear this. They don't maybe understand the term, but I'm a classic introvert. Like, I'm a talkative introvert, where I'm not socially awkward, I know I'm not shy, but I'd much rather be alone. Like, I like spending time at home, on the couch, watching hockey, watching shows, things like that with my fiance. I don't need to be constantly stimulated outdoors. Like, I don't get bored at home. I can stay in my home for like 2 months straight and never leave outside of maybe going to the gym, and I'd be perfectly happy and I'd never be bored.
I want to ask you also about kind of the aha moments. I always find those to be great. You know, baseball is often my vocation, so I'll often ask players about their first major league hit because it's everybody remembers, oh yeah, I was in Cincinnati and this happened, whatever. In poker, it's obviously a continuum. And, you know, you win your first tournament, maybe you win your first bracelet, what have you. But sometimes I would guess that you would have a feeling of beating a certain person. In other words, you conquered Toronto, maybe you went to Vegas and you sat down with some legend and you got the best of him. Or maybe you did something that you tactically hadn't done before and it totally worked and it became part of your game. Can you identify, if not the first aha moment, maybe one of the bigger formative ones, or was there one? Or maybe it was just like, yeah, it just kept getting better. There wasn't really one thing. It all blends together.
So I would say at the moment for me, it was the first World Series poker that I played. The very first table when I was seated at was all like legends of the game. The wow. Johnny Chan, TJ Cloutier, and all the
like,
so I was like, oh boy, you know, I'm not matched here. I'm in trouble. And then I made a move on Johnny Chan that got through, and I thought, okay, never mind. I can actually play with these guys, progressed to the tournament. This was my first ever World Series event. Made it to the final table, ended up winning the event. So I was 23, the youngest player ever. And that moment, you know, really sort of, I was already been having some success on sort of the smaller minor circuit, but this was my first foray into like a bigger event against the top pros, and I was able to compete. So that was a moment where I realized, like, you know, that my game had arrived, that it was much better than I thought it was.
Well, and you framed it in terms of aggression, too, because, you know, obviously in poker, there's all kinds of ways that you can win. If you lay down in the right situation, that could be the thing that ends up ultimately winning you the bracelet. But the thing that you said, which struck me, was I made a move on Johnny Chan. You know, you pushed, you shoved. Is that what we're talking about? Is fundamentally the nature of this game that for you to really, really get it requires aggression at the right time? You know, does that just outflank everything else by a wide margin, or is it a matter of mastering your passivity? I know that's kind of an open-ended question, but I just love the way that you framed that. You said, I made a move. That to me implies, oh, I shoved. I didn't have the cards, but I shoved on him.
Yeah, that's not quite what happened. It was just a check raise, and it was just a smaller move. But, yeah, no, I wouldn't say that, like, aggression is, you know, the barometer, per se. It's simply just, you know, understanding this. Whatever the table is doing, so if the table is too aggressive and wild and everybody's crazy, well, then you need to notice that, recognize that, and then pull back, play more conservatively, and wait for them to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Conversely, if everyone's playing real tight to best, very careful, and, you know, nobody's, like, taking any gambles, now you can push them around like the bully at the table. The real key to becoming a good poker player is the self-awareness and the understanding of what are they doing, what are these players doing now, what's in their heads, what is their psychological profile, and then coming up with a counter strategy to best exploit that.
Hmm. Malcolm Gladwell, I believe it was in The Tipping Point, he talked about the 10,000 hours. He said that Bill Gates got 10,000 hours of practice programming.
That was actually, it was in Outliers.
It was in Outliers. I got the book wrong.
Yep.
But it was Gladwell. So he talks about the 10,000 hours, and he talks about how key it is. And we were sat at the table last night and joking around and having drinks and playing, and we were thinking about how many hours would it be in poker, and it seems like it would probably take way more than 10,000 hours to be a world-class poker player. And I don't necessarily need you to quantify it, but, you know, what are we talking about? If I'm 15, I'm 15, I'm from Ville-Saint-Laurent, Quebec, instead of from North York, Ontario, or from Toronto, Ontario, but I want to be a really good poker player, what level of commitment are we talking about to even have a shot at it? Or is this so talent and intellect-based that it's like playing in the NBA, and if I say I want to play in the NBA, it's probably not going to happen no matter how hard I try?
Well, no, I actually think Gladwell's spot on with 10,000 hours. I think it actually really applies well to poker, especially in the live scenario. Having said that, if you're an online poker player, what you can do is you can play 4, 6, 8, 10 tables at a time.
Yes.
That expedites the learning process exponentially. So for a lot of these guys, you know, they can cram sort of 4 years worth of learning into 6 months to 8 months. So within 3 to 4 years, if you're smart and you work really hard, absolutely, you know, you could reach world class if you have that innate ability, you know, IQ and all the things necessary to be a great player.
I want to talk about pulse a little bit because one of my friends brought it up and he said, you need to ask him this. And I thought this was really interesting. You referenced meditation and you referenced mental well-being and so forth, but there are tells in poker, obviously. What does one do to get to kind of shut it down? Because, you know, you mentioned that you were jovial at the table and that you do come across as kind of open. Is it just that you never waver from that sort of persona and therefore nobody can read you because you're always kind of, you know, a little bit more vocal and a little bit more loose? Or are you really hardcore focusing on pulse, focusing on eye movement? And I mean, how granular do you go to control your body movements at the table?
So I'm very unique as a poker player. They're different than most, like especially at the higher level. People are really stoic and they try to be robotic in their movements and look at the same way and try to avoid. Like we have one guy now who has a hoodie named Christoph Wolfelsen.
Yes.
He pulls up over his head and it looks very similar to foreskin on a penis. It really does. Like if you look at a picture of Christoph Wolfelsen, you will see him hooded up and it looks like foreskin on a penis. So he goes to that extreme. For me, I'm much more jovial, and I feel like I throw enough mixed signals, and I mix it up enough where what people believe is a reliable tell is something that I'm conscious of, so I'm throwing a lot of, like, reverse fake tells to keep them off my back. I don't recommend that, though, unless you're really experienced at it, because typically, you know, players who do that give away a lot more than they get. And there are certain players where I just don't do anything else for robotics because I have a lot of respect for their ability to read through. And I have a real good understanding of how I play. But if I'm up against a player who I don't feel can read into me very much, I'll do a lot of different things to try to exploit that player.
I want to talk about the rise of the sport as well. And, you know, you came in, obviously a lot of this kind of thing has to do with timing. As great as Doyle Brunson was, for instance, you know, he didn't have quite the monetary opportunities that exist for the modern player because the sport exploded. A bunch of stuff happened and you happened to come along at a time where you were really good and your timing was impeccable. So, you know, one of the things that struck me just reading a little bit about you was you got in early in terms of being a spokesperson, in terms of sponsorship. What Was that just kind of out of necessity? It was sort of, you know, I need to have a bankroll regardless of whether or not I'm on a streak, and therefore I'm going to get involved in this? Did you see that as an opportunity to grow the game? How does one come into that? Or is it just like it's part of the DNA of the sport, the same way that auto racers obviously have decals on your car? Obviously, you're going to have something on your baseball cap, and everybody does it.
Yeah, so it was not out of necessity. It was already a millionaire at the time.
Okay.
It was quite well in cash games. It's just another, you know, avenue and another vertical to increase your bankroll, to make more money, to also grow the game as you said. So it's all full. But there are some people who depend upon it, you know, a sponsorship in order to survive. I was good enough before the boom, and I had, you know, enough of a bankroll where that wasn't sort of in my mindset. But, you know, a company comes to you and says they want to work with you on a deal, and you believe in the company, you feel like, you know, you want to represent them, I don't see why you wouldn't.
How did you feel about the boom as somebody who had established yourself and, you know, you had your own ways and you could make money and you could do that? Was it, oh, great, now every frat boy is going to come along and challenge me at a table and here we go? Was it, I welcome this, I'm an ambassador to the sport and this is great to see more people? Was it somewhere in between? Did you feel ambiguity about it? Because the sport, you know, it's still the same rules. It's not a complicated sport. It is and it isn't. I mean, the rules are what they are, but the nature of it and the size of it and the scope of it just fundamentally changed, and it felt like it changed pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting for me because I was one of the players that was probably more prominently featured on TV shows, so
yes.
I was sitting at tables now with a lot of new people I've never seen before. Having said that, they knew how I played, and they probably knew a lot of my plays. So it became a little more tricky in terms of, you know, navigating the field, but realistically, it was actually beneficial because I could figure out pretty quickly what they see and use that to my advantage so that I could, you know, manipulate them in other ways. But, you know, for those that, you know, were part of the boom, the benefit was all these new players, they didn't have the experience or the skill level, so it just was pretty easy at that point.
Well, and it's, you just touched on it too, that the idea of being on camera and being on shows and so forth. I guess, you know, any professional sport is like that to a certain extent. You know, if you're in the Super Bowl, if you're Tom Brady, you know, you're playing, it's a given, you're going to play in front of 90,000 people. Is that a different skill? You know, you're going along and you've really mastered your reads and you know when to push and you know when to fold and so forth. And now it's, oh, and I also have to know how to smile and I also have to know how to make the producers happy. I mean, is that something that you had to study and figure out to really get good at? It was not only a revenue stream for you, but it was, you know, very much a part of your persona and lifestyle, or was it, you know what, I'm a personable guy, they're going to like me no matter what?
So that's one of the other things that gave me a big advantage, is that I'm very comfortable on camera and always was.
Yep.
And there's no real thought or no effort required to me, so it's like going, oh, I better act. It's just very natural for me. What wasn't natural for most of my opponents. Like, a lot of my opponents would freeze under the light, under the cameras, for the constant, like, media exposure, having an audience, things like that. That was my comfort zone. And it gave me an even bigger advantage, and there was no real ever conscious effort to say, I'm going to be, you know, a showman. I just always am like that anyway. Like, it was basically reality TV at its best, if you will, because it's real people playing for life-changing amounts of money and reacting the way that, you know, that they do.
And I always wonder, too, about random chance versus, you know, skill, that this is, it's very much a game of both. And if you've got two evenly matched players, then, or close to evenly matched, then random chance can come into it. And so I'm going to try to pose a question that might be impossible to answer, but we'll give it a go. You've got a person who's pretty good. You know, they play twice a week in their home game. They understand pot odds down pat. They've read Super System. They've been playing for 20 years and all that stuff. But they're not a pro. They're not a pro. They never will be a pro. They're not going to get there. They're fine. They're fine in their own little hometown or whatever. You sit down with that person. It's a typical session. Acknowledging that random chance comes into it, acknowledging you're way, way, way better than this person. What percentage of the time are you beating that person?
That's going to depend on the structure of what you're doing. So, for example, like extreme example, right? Let's say you and me, we had one chip each.
Yep.
Okay, that's it. Just one chip each. Well, on the very first time we put the one chip in, so it's 50-50.
Sure.
Either you win or I win, because it's whatever. Now let's say we each have three chips. Okay, well, maybe now it's not 50-50, but it's like 51. And now give us each 100 chips. Okay, now all of a sudden there's an advantage. Let's go to 1,000 chips, or, you know, 1,000,000 chips, and by that point you're like never going to win.
Yeah.
So really it depends on, you know, the long term and how much, you know, play that you have, if you will. So faster paced tournaments or structured things like that give the weaker player an advantage because it levels the playing field. But if it's a slower paced thing, like a World Series main event that takes 7 days to play, by the end, you know, the best player is just going to win.
is, I mean, Texas Hold'em was the one that got glorified above all others, but obviously you can play Omaha, you can play different variations or whatever. Do you view Hold'em as the platonic ideal, or do you feel like, oh, that's one of many, and game X could have easily become the big one too? Like, what is there something really, really special about Texas Hold'em that separates it, or it's just that's what it was, and so I went with the flow. That was the game that I ended up playing, and that I ended up getting rich and famous off of.
So I play all the games, and I actually prefer playing all the games, and I prefer all other games over to Limit
Hold'em. Really?
The reason No Limit Hold'em specifically was the one that took off was because it was very, very simple to understand for the audience, very easy to learn the rules and play and follow along. Like, if you were to put something like, and I have tried this, studied or better on TV, it's much more complex and complicated and split pots and things like that, so it doesn't work as well. Also, the No Limit aspect create sort of a little bit more drama, and it's really all about TV driving the game and helping it grow, because people watch it on TV, then they want to play it.
Sure.
And No Limit Hold'em was probably, from a television perspective, like, the perfect game to, you know, translate well to, you know, the casual fan.
Interesting. All right, I want to ask you a little bit about Masterclass. You've taught many different forms of poker, whether it's celebrities who wanted to learn, whether it's people you know, what have you, but, you know, Masterclass is something that I know you've put a lot of work into. What does one get out of it? Who would be the right person to take it? Is it somebody who's already pretty good, or is it somebody who's starting out? And then what can one learn from taking a class with you?
So the Masterclass, I would say that for the ranked beginner that doesn't know the rules and never played poker, it's probably going to be a little bit too advanced for you. Okay. What Masterclass likes to do is they get experts in the field, whatever they are, like Usher teaches dance, Christina Aguilera literally teaches, you know, singing and all those types of huge celebrities in their field. So and they want something a little more high-end. So if you're already playing poker and you want to improve your game, Masterclass is very likely to do that. We break it down into very specific modules. Like, there's a whole section on body language, picking up tells that can translate to not only, you know, helping you at the poker table, but also in business deals, like understanding when people are lying to you and looking for specific body language tells to pick that up. Also, fundamentally, learning a little bit about, you know, the more advanced concepts that have sort of been, you know, at the forefront the last couple of years. One called GTO, which is Game Theory Optimal. We talk a little bit about that and different things. So I think for the price point especially, like, and the amount of information, typically, like, the masterclass that I did, if I were to do something similar to that in a day for a group, that would be, you know, $50,000 worth of value.
Wow.
And instead, you can get it for, like, $90, which is, I think, a pretty darn good deal.
No doubt about it. All right, I got one last question for you. Auston Matthews is going to be Maple Leaf for the next 5 years. He's getting the second highest salary in the NHL. The Maple Leafs, your entire life, have been mostly bad. 93 was fun, but there hasn't been much going on. How excited are you as a diehard fan with this signing, with this team, as good as they are? Kyle Dubas, the boy wonder, is the general manager. I know you've got, obviously, your life, you've got your family and so forth, but you're pretty hardcore when it comes to the Leafs. Are you just walking around with a perpetual smile and jersey on you at this point pretty much all the time?
So I have to update you on this, because please. I'm a Golden Knights.
What? Whoa, hang on. Oh, I do need the update. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm a Golden Knights fan. I live in Las Vegas. I help bring the team here. You know, I'm very happy with the progress they're making. I still root for Toronto because, you know, that's the team I grew up on. I actually abandoned the Toronto Maple Leafs when they traded Tuukka Rask many, many years ago.
Interesting.
And, you know, I was very disappointed in sort of the approach they took. I am happy to see what they've been doing with the rebuild, and it's fun to watch. The deal for Auston Matthews is a good one. I am a hockey nut. I watch all the games. I bet on tons of games. I have an account on Twitter, which we're losing at right now. It's NHL hockey bets. We're down a little bit, but, you know, that's hockey. So I'm definitely a diehard fan of the Golden Knights and secondarily so the Toronto Maple Leafs, so it's exciting to see. I don't think the Toronto Maple Leafs or Golden Knights are going to stand up this year, but both teams are fun to watch.
I have a couple of follow-up questions immediately. One is, what do you make of the explosion of sports betting? The fact that now, obviously, you live in Nevada, it's really easy for you, but now you can be in Jersey, you can be in Pennsylvania, you can be in West Virginia. It's not only coming, but it's here. You've got the commissioner of the NBA writing editorials in the New York Times. You've got the commissioner of Major League Baseball. All these things that have existed in Britain for quite a while, it's now arriving. Do you feel like this is overdue? Do you think it's going to get the growth and penetration that people expect? You think it'll be slow going? I mean, where are we with this?
Well, I'm all for personal freedom of choice.
Right? Yes.
People want to sit in the theater at home and play online poker, they should have that right. If they want to bet on a sports game, they should have the right to choose how they spend their money in any which way. The idea that, you know, the government needs to play like Big Daddy and protect you from that is kind of silly, so I'm glad to see the movement. I do think a lot of the innovations, especially in the NHL, with a lot of, like, you know, the chip in the puck, there's going to be so many unique ways to live bet that I think creates interest. Like, if you look at what drives the NFL, it's not, you know, when people are watching an 0-8 team playing 1-17, they're only watching that game for one specific reason. They have money on it, period. Otherwise, they do not care about this game. It's useless to them. So
yes.
I think, you know, creating that for other sports and giving people the opportunity drives TV ratings. It's good for everyone involved, and I see no downside whatsoever.
And no downside, presumably, to switching teams, right? Because I'm a Montreal Canadiens fan. They've been horrible forever. I've kind of more or less abandoned them, even though I moved back to Montreal after being gone for 20 years, growing up here and then coming back. So it's okay to get rid of the team that you grew up with. There's nothing, there's no baggage. You don't have to be dealing with any guilt. You could just say, you know what? I moved to Vegas. I'm a night, and obviously I'm involved with the franchise in some ways. I could be a fan, or I just live in Columbus and I, you know, was a Blackhawks fan, but now I'm here. I could do that. Or there's no reason at all. Can we just switch jerseys? Is this okay as a sports fan, as a personal choice thing? Or do we need to bear the brunt of guilt and bad feelings that we've abandoned the team that we grew up with?
Well, I think that whole line of thought is pretty damn stupid, and I definitely want to be like, oh, you can't root for the Leafs anymore. You're bad. And I'm like, listen, I live in Las Vegas. I have 16 season tickets. I go to every game. Obviously, I'm going to be rooting for this team. You know, it's fun. It's like a new team. Having said that, I can root for multiple teams. I root for Vegas. I root for Toronto. I Phil Kessel's a buddy of mine. He plays in Pittsburgh. I have another friend named Jake Howerlook who plays for Florida. Mm-hmm. So I root for them when they're playing. I bet on a lot of teams, so I root for the team I'm betting on as well. But it's especially cool when Vegas and Toronto is, they're in different conferences.
Yes.
So the only real dilemma I would ever have is if they're in the finals. And I don't think it's, you know, very likely. And if it were, I mean, I've been living in Vegas for 20 years of the last 20 years. It would be silly for me not to be a fan here. But as I said, I still have, you know, a little bit of my heart for Toronto, and I'm always going to root for them. And I bet on Toronto last night, -1.5 goals. They won 6-1.
Beautiful.
Go Leafs, go.
Nicely done. Daniel Negreanu, what a pleasure. I really appreciate your time. And thank you so much for doing this.
All right, you got it, bud.